beach sunsets.
This is what you'll miss?
Yeah. The sandpipers on the sand. I used to have a fish fry with my grandpa, and I'll miss that. And summer fun.
Do you really think all this is gone?
It'll be gone for a while, but I'm sure it might come back.
River and his family in Grand Isle, standing in front of the 101 white crosses they erected for their dreams that have been devastated on the Gulf of Mexico in Grand Isle. To see all of our coverage and listen to and read our coverage on the Gulf of Mexico, you can go to democracynow.org. Democracy Now! Is produced by Mike Burke, Shufa Dokadus, Aaron Mate, Angelique Comet, Steve Martinez, Nicole Salazar, Hani Massoud, Robbie Karen, Mike DeFilippo, Miguel Nogueira, our engineer. Special thanks to Becca Staley, Julie Crosby, Karen Renucci, Nick Gilla, Hugh Grant, Samantha Chamblee, Miriam Barnard, Brenda Murat, Jessel Noor, Vesta Godars, our camera crew, Kieran Krugmeadows, Rakan Penny, Travis Collins. Again, our website is democracynow.org. Our Independence Day special, an hour with filmmaker Michael Moore. I'm Amy Goodman.
The following is brought to you by Echo Weekly.
Good afternoon. My name is Sean Rosen. I am the owner and publisher of Echo Weekly. My voice does not lend itself to radio commercials. The reason? Each commercial is approximately 30 seconds. Echo Weekly, free every Thursday.
Come one, come all, and check out on the Shelf, your friendly neighborhood queer library and resource center. Out on the Shelf can provide you with over 2,000 book titles of special interest to your needs or your curiosities. We also have a countless variety of magazines, movie titles, pamphlets, and many other queer and trans resources available for you and the community. So come on in and visit us at Out on the Shelf, located at 141 Woolwich Street at the base of the Matrix building on the corner of Aramasa, and meet some of our many volunteers who work hard to keep our space safe and confidential. Help yourself to a cup of tea, browse the shelves, or kick up your feet and crack open one of your favorite books. To find out our hours and learn more on Out on the Shelf, please check out outontheshelf.ca or give us a call at 519-515-0691.
Starkraven Radio. The first three Tuesdays of each month. From 1 to 2 p.m., we take a closer look at the politics of prisons and criminalization on your community radio station, CFRU 93.3 FM in Guelph.
Paddle Slower Music Festival, Saturday, July 10th, 2010.
A free one-day floating outdoor music festival on the Speed and Aramosa Rivers.
Featuring performances by
Wax Mannequin,
Jenny Omnicord,
Lisa Bozikovic,
Ennis Wilson and his opposition,
Whoopso,
J.J. Ibsen,
Steve Sladkowski and friends,
Nick Moore, Ashley Hellier, and many more. Canoe to see the performances or walk along the river to find them.
While a limited number of canoes will be available for rental on site, attendees are encouraged to bring their own canoe, kayak, or raft.
July 10th, 1:30, starting with an advanced paddling workshop.
Brought to you in part by Out of Sound Records, CFRU, and Ed Video.
Treading water in a rising flood.
CFRU, the little station that plays the harmonica.
No, Bruce.
That's right, Bruce.
The level of unemployment in the United States fell in June to 9.5%, the lowest figure in almost a year. This was 125,000 jobs during the same month. Analysts said there had been a drop in the number of Americans actively looking for work and therefore counted as unemployed. The jobs market itself remained weak. President Obama said the figures showed that the U.S. economy was heading in the right direction, but not fast enough. Brazil have been knocked out of the World Cup. The Netherlands won their quarter-final match, beating the Brazilians by 2-1. Shortly, Ghana will try to make history by becoming the first African country to reach a World Cup semi-final when they play Uruguay. And those are the latest stories from BBC News.
It's 16:06 GMT. You're listening to the BBC World Service. I'm James Kamara-Sami with Europe Today. Oranje boven, the orange are on top. That's the sentiment in the Netherlands this evening after the Dutch football team defeated the five-time World Cup winner Brazil to book themselves a place in the semi-finals of this World Cup. They came from behind to win 2-1 in what was a famous victory.
Holland are seconds away from the semi-final as the Japanese referee blows for full-time. Brazil led through Robinho early on, but a Felipe Melo own goal and a point-blank header from Wesley Sneijder means that Holland are through and Brazil are out. Full-time in Port Elizabeth, Holland 2, Brazil 1.
Well, we can go to South Africa now and talk to the BBC's Richard Connolly. Richard, quite a game.
Extraordinary game, James, yes. And a game which I thought at half-time Brazil were almost certain to win, to be truthful. They'd taken the lead 10 minutes in through Robinho and on a couple of occasions had produced the kind of footballing move, and I don't really exaggerate here, that were reminiscent of the great Brazil team of the late 1960s and 1970. They were playing with tremendous confidence and had far more of the possession than the Dutch team, which also thrives on keeping the ball for long periods, but Brazil were more effective at that and restricted the Dutch to very few opportunities in that first 45 minutes. At the start of the second half, however, a lofted ball in from Wesley Sneijder, the Dutch midfield player who had another excellent game today, drifted into the Brazilian box seemingly harmlessly, but Julio Cesar, the excellent Brazilian goalkeeper, and Felipe Melo, the midfield player, had a breakdown in communication. The ball glanced off Felipe Melo's head and into the net for what was an own goal. And from that moment, everything changed. Everything changed. The Dutch were on top. They got a second goal through Sneijder with a header from a corner. The Brazilians completely self-destructed, as witnessed by Felipe Melo's sending off for a stamp on Robin, and the Dutch are through.
And, of course, what everyone had been saying about that Brazilian team was that they have such a strong defence. So the own goal, incredibly ironic.
Well, that was the key moment of the match. And, I mean, their defence has been absolutely watertight up to this point. I mean, they conceded a couple of goals in the early stages, but, I mean, they look very strong. And even in this game, they look very strong, particularly centrally, where the two centre-backs were having good games, particularly Juan of Roma, who was excellent, with Felipe Melo and Gilberto Silva just in front. But Felipe Melo's game went from excellent. I mean, he played the through ball for Robinho in the first half, to woeful. He then scored an own goal and got himself sent off. Let's not forget to give credit to the Dutch, though, and Robin in particular was outstanding.
Well, we will be giving credit to the Dutch because we're going now to the Netherlands, but for the time being, Richard Connolly, thanks very much. Let's go speak to Martha Dekker, journalist at Radio Netherlands. Martha, I'm just giving a bit of a pause there. I was going to ask you what the reaction there is, but I think that sound says it all.
We are very excited.
Very excited.
We all are very excited, yes.
Did you think they could win this one?
No, absolutely not, no. We got quite a history with Brazil and the Brazilian team, and there were not a lot of people who were very convinced that the Dutch would win. No, absolutely not.
No, because I mean, you went into this World Cup as one of the favourites, but haven't been doing perhaps as well as you might have been. You've had a few injuries, and Brazil seemed to be coming to form, and then you went 1-0 down. So,
well, I think that was somehow that seemed very good for the Dutch team, because then we got kind of excited, and the Brazilian team kind of went down in their form. And the Dutch went crazy. So therefore, we won, I think.
You won. You've beaten Brazil. And now it's, either Ghana or Uruguay.
Ghana, Uruguay, yeah. Well, it's going to be exciting as well tonight. Do you want to hear my preference?
I would like to hear your preference.
I think Uruguay would be a great game.
It would be a good game. And I guess having beaten the Brazilians, confidence must be very, very high.
I'm not
high.
Sure. We have to be very careful with that prediction. Hopefully for the Dutch team.
What sort of celebrations are they going to be taking place tonight, do you think?
Oh, I think a lot of people drink quite a bit tonight in the cities and in the pubs.
I think we can safely assume that.
It's warm weather in the Netherlands as well, so I think a lot of people have a great weekend. And, our next game, Tuesday, 8:30.
And will you be watching that?
Of course.
You'll be watching it, will you?
Yes, in a pub, huh?
In a pub. So great celebrations there in the Netherlands.
Thank you very much.
Martha Dekker from Radio Netherlands, thanks very much. Well, let's now speak to the football writer Simon Cooper. He's a football journalist. He's in Johannesburg at the moment. Grew up in the Netherlands, so he knows all about Dutch football. Simon, how do you feel?
Amazed, awed, one of the best moments of my life, but really surprised. And I looked at Mark van Bommel celebrating the second goal going in, and his face was amazement. He didn't understand how we had gone from 1-0 down against Brazil, a team that doesn't give away anything, to beat them. And Marcel's right, after the second goal went in, it was all our game, we just controlled it. So I'm flabbergasted.
Because going into this, as I was saying with Martha, the Dutch weren't the fancy team by any means, were they?
No, I mean, I think we've had a very decent World Cup. We're very hard to beat. We're a good counter-attacking side. But Brazil is a much better counter-attacking side, or has been so far this World Cup. I was just amazed that Brazil collapsed like a pudding. And I think it just shows that the Dutch tradition is incredibly strong. I mean, I see elements in 74 of 98 here. And, you know, yes, some aspects are different. But we've done this without a team of 11 great players. We've done this with a team of about 6 great players. And that's a real tribute. The Dutch football tradition.
The Dutch have come very close on 2 occasions, 74-78, the losing finalists. There's a real hunger in the Netherlands to finally win it, isn't there?
Those times we lost to the hosts, that's not going to happen this time. Playing the hosts in the final is a very cruel fate. I do fear that I think we'll get to the final, and I think we'll play Argentina or Spain. And I think we'll lose, and I don't know how we as a nation will be able to bear it.
Oh, please don't. Simon, what about the next round? On paper, potentially easier than Brazil, but we heard from Martha Dekker there sounding a note of caution in the Netherlands about getting too excited about beating Uruguay or Ghana.
Well, a key element of the Dutch football tradition is arrogance. And I'm very confident that we will beat Uruguay or Ghana. I mean, Holland has an excellent record against African sides. Uruguay are just not Brazil. I mean, they're not just as good, weaker on paper, they're also weaker on grass. So I this is Dutch hubris, but I can really see us in the final next week.
Okay, Simon Cooper, thanks very much. And I have to say, my household, my Dutch wife and half Dutch children, pretty happy as well. Anyway, you're listening to the BBC World Service. This is Europe Today. Still to come on the programme, Dignitas, the Swiss assisted suicide group, gives us a rare interview.
As a human rights lawyer, I am persuaded that the right to make an end-of-life decision belongs to every person who has capacity of discernment. And I want to implement this last human right.
That's coming up later on in the programme. Now, alcohol has always had a special place in Russian life. As anyone who spent time in that country knows, the odd shot or two of vodka usually helps to lubricate a business meeting, no matter what time of day, while it's the height of rudeness not to finish a bottle of vodka once it's been opened. But there is, of course, a downside to this cultural affinity with strong drink. Alcohol abuse is one of the main reasons why life expectancy in Russia is so low. And it's something the Kremlin now seems serious about tackling ever since the teetotal former president Vladimir Putin came to power. This sobriety has even inspired a pop song. I want a man like Putin, a man who doesn't drink, the song goes. Well, Mr. Putin's successor in the Kremlin, President Dmitry Medvedev, has taken up that mantle. And today, in the latest anti-alcohol measure, Russia's parliament has approved a new law calling for zero tolerance on drink driving. Judging from these reactions in Moscow, it appears to be a popular one.
I think this law should be even stricter, especially when it comes to spirits. If my husband drinks even a little, I don't let him drive.
I never drink and drive. Even if I just have a small beer, I don't. I don't like drinking. I think this law is a good idea.
Someone who is drunk isn't the same as someone who is sober. A drunk person can fight, yes, they can dance. But to drive and take responsibility for their actions behind the wheel, this is another matter.
It's a good law for Russians because they can't just drink a little. They'll say they've had just a drop, but really they've had much more.
Well, I've been speaking to Patricia Helihi from Brown University in the United States, who's the author of The Alcoholic Empire, Vodka and Politics in Late Imperial Russia. And she's currently working on a book called The Global History of Vodka. I asked her what she thinks of the new law.
I think that's a particularly well-intentioned gesture, but I'm afraid it won't be very effective.
Why not?
Well, for one thing, the corruption with the police. One can bribe oneself out of any kind of testing. And with the volume of testing required, it's doubtful that they could even keep up with the demand.
Well, listening to people talking on the streets of Moscow, they do seem in favor of this law. You don't think there is a change of mood since President Putin, then President Putin, now President Medvedev came to power?
Yes, there is a certain change, I think. Certainly Putin and Medvedev themselves are not, unlike Yeltsin, reputed to be heavy drinkers. So there's a kind of a model there of sobriety that might be emulated.
And a recognition, would you say, of the fact that many of Russia's problems, such as its demographic problems, do in some part stem from the heavy drinking?
The demographic crisis is very tightly linked with alcoholism, and I know that's a concern of Medvedev. He called it a national disaster not too long ago.
But you're skeptical about the fact that they might be able to really make inroads into what is very deeply ingrained in the Russian culture, this drinking.
Yes, I think, and I see no harm in attacking it on all fronts, as they have lately been doing, raising the taxes on beer and vodka, but there's a limit to the effectiveness. As you said, it's deeply ingrained in the culture.
We've talked about the long history of Russians drinking vodka, but there's also a history of Russian rulers trying to combat that, isn't it? They've tried, for example, by attempting to provide entertainment as a distraction.
Absolutely, yes. That's exactly what happened with the establishment of the first vodka monopoly at the end of the 19th century. It was thought that the common people drank from boredom. There was an attempt to distract them. And Gorbachev, I remember during that period, they'd have alcohol-free restaurants with little quartets playing, poetry reading. The attempt was to raise the culture.
But of course, Gorbachev was derided as the mineral water president, wasn't he? Will it be any different this time?
Well, I think politically they're not going to risk that. They understood that, you know. Nicholas II was out of office pretty soon after his enactment of the prohibition in 1914. Gorbachev was out of office too, partially because of his huge unpopularity, because of his attempt to curb drinking. So I think they have to tread softly with regard to the population if they are too heavy-handed. And of course, there's a lot of financial interest tied up with the sale of vodka, which is no longer a monopoly.
But given there is a more popular administration in power at the moment, does that mean that they perhaps do have a better chance of changing attitudes?
Possibly. I think it's their approach to youth, and Putin tried to do that by going to a hip-hop bar and saying, you know, breakdancing and hip-hop is much better than drinking vodka. But I suspect the milieu in which he said it had plenty of vodka. So the model effect, if there is one, ripple down from the two leaders, at least publicly perceived as fairly sober men, might have some attraction to the younger generation.
And that was Patricia Helihi, an expert on vodka, speaking to me from the United States. You're listening to the BBC World Service. This is Europe Today. Now, the discovery this April of dozens of urns containing human ashes, apparently dumped in Lake Zurich, has focused attention once again on the Swiss assisted suicide organisation Dignitas. An investigation into who put the urns into the lake is underway, and we should stress that no one has yet been charged. But the discovery has led to a much wider debate on Switzerland's laws on assisted suicide and what exactly organisations like Dignitas are allowed to do. In a moment, we'll be hearing a rare interview with the head of Dignitas, Ludwig Minelli. But first, this report from Imogen Folks.
Okay, am 29. Oktober 2008 habe ich Strafanzeige erstattet.
Soraya Wernli is a woman with a mission. Her small house in the countryside outside Zurich is crammed with papers, documents relating to an organisation she used to work for, Dignitas. The discovery of urns in Lake Zurich came as no surprise to her. She claims she's been telling the authorities about it for years.
It was late summer when Mr. Minelli asked me to drive with him to Lake Zurich. When we got there, he opened the boot of the car and it was full of urns. He used a screwdriver to take off the nameplates and then he threw them in the lake. I was present once when he did this and never again.
Soraya left Dignitas because she says of her concerns about the way its founder, Ludwig Minelli, ran the organisation. Dignitas won't comment on the urns, although it does confirm some of its clients agreed to their ashes being put in Lake Zurich. But the discovery has opened a wider debate over Switzerland's laws on assisted suicide and what exactly organisations like Dignitas are allowed to do. Margaret Leuthold of Switzerland's National Committee on Medical Ethics.
They are under discussion, first of all, because the whole financial transactions are not really clear. And second, there have been a few reported cases where it's not clear that the persons who committed assisted suicide did this really with their full mental capacity.
Swiss public opinion is beginning to say no, not to assisted suicide, which most people continue to believe should be a personal decision, but no to no controls over organisations which offer to provide the assistance. On Zurich's busy streets, it was hard to find a voice in favour of Dignitas.
The whole idea is a good idea, I think, but Dignitas as an organisation is focused on one person, on a lawyer who makes his money with Dignitas.
It's Dignitas. It comes from dignity, but it's not a very dignified way, the way they go about it. It's just business.
It's not very nice. They took a lot of money and nobody likes them wherever they go.
The Swiss government has now drafted proposals which would limit assisted suicide to those with terminal illnesses and require that each case is reviewed over a lengthy period by two doctors. Margaret Leuthold of the Committee on Medical Ethics supports the government's decision to act.
The government has an obligation to protect its citizens, and therefore we think these organisations should have some governance by the state. It cannot be that organisations which deal with life and death of citizens are just, you know, free acting.
Getting new laws onto the statute book will be a long and complicated process. There will be no change overnight. Nevertheless, Switzerland's policy on assisted suicide does look set to become more restrictive.
That was Imogen Folks reporting. Well, as I mentioned, the head of Dignitas, Ludwig Minelli, doesn't speak to the media very often, but he has given an interview to Imogen Folks. She asked him to explain his philosophy on assisted suicide.
We have to struggle in order to implement the last human right in our societies. And the last human right is the right to make a decision upon one's own end and the possibility to have this end without risks and without pains.
Many people would say, though, that if there's to be an organisation which organises assisted suicide, if you like, that there should be some rules around how they function.
Well, there are rules, but there are no state rules. We have our own rules. And the first rule is that we never precipitate an assisted suicide. Every step must be initiated by the member itself and not by us. And the third rule is that we are always first looking whether we will be able to help somebody to continue with life instead to end the life.
What about the structure of your organisation? The media has reported on it that it's not entirely transparent, particularly the accounting part of it.
Well, this is a private association, and only the active members of the association have a right to know the facts, and the public has no right at all. First, we are not working with public money. We are working with the money of our members, and as long as our members agree with our work, there's no reason to answer questions from third parties.
Nevertheless, many people here in Switzerland would be more comfortable if your organisation was more transparent.
Maybe, but this is not our first issue. Our first issue is to help our members, and as long as the authorities, which are competent, do not say that something is wrong with us, there's no need for more transparency.
The thing is, you've been through all the authorities with me, and basically you've dismissed them all as incompetent or biased.
They are. I'm very sorry.
Can I ask you about the Dignitas philosophy on people who would come to you who are mentally ill rather than physically ill? Why you think that it's okay for you to help somebody who has a major mental illness like schizophrenia to commit suicide?
Well, as a human rights lawyer, I am persuaded that the right to make an end-of-life decision belongs to every person who has capacity of discernment. Most persons with a mental illness have full capacity of discernment, of course. And I think this capacity to make an end-of-life decision should also apply to a healthy person. So the British discussion about terminally ill persons is completely obsolete. And I want to implement this last human right.
What if somebody came to you who was neither physically nor mentally ill, but expressed the wish to die? Would you be able to help them?
Of course. For instance, a very old person which has no illnesses at all, has some difficulties because in old age you will have some difficulties, has no longer family, has no longer friends. Why should we say no?
And that was Imogen Folk speaking to Ludwig Minnelli, the head of Dignitas. And do tell us your view on this very sensitive topic. Is Dignitas doing the right thing? You can post on our Facebook page, BBC Europe Today, or you can send us an email at worldhaveyoursay@bbc.com. Do stay with us. You are listening to Europe Today here on the BBC World Service from London.
If you're new to the BBC World Service and are trying to work out what's on when, we've got a neat little way to help you. Go to bbcworldservice.com and click How and When to listen.
Details of all our services.
الرابعة